Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme.
Should we define the suburbs by their location or by their activities or by their socioeconomic kind of cultural definitions? There's lots of ways to talk about it.
Do you think FIFO is a character from a children's story? Maybe you're wondering if the urburb is a piece of clever viral marketing for this very show. Today, we consult the Urbanism Dictionary, not to be confused with the Urban Dictionary. That's a whole other story, in the hopes of unravelling some acronyms and illuminating the jargon frequently thrown around in the realm of city discourse. What secrets are the Dutch hiding in the Woonerf? And how has the global pandemic encouraged citizens' NIMBYism? That's all coming up right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. First up today, we look at a new classification for the changing nature of suburbs.
Urb-urb. Noun. A neologism referring to the blend of urban and suburban characteristics in a city area.
Defining areas in our cities can be important in order to direct the right services to them and to monitor their growth and health over the long term. So, to shed some light on this particular definition, I'm joined now by Ellen Dunham-Jones, the architectural educator and author of Retrofitting Suburbia, as well as the more recent case studies in Retrofitting Suburbia, which was released in January of this year. Ellen, you're somewhat of an authority on the suburbs. Tell us how this term urburb came about, as well as a few other creative examples of the burb suffix.
Absolutely. It is kind of fascinating. There's the stereotype of the suburb and suburbia, and yet people keep coming up with these terms because that stereotype is so outdated. The urb-urb word came out in 2014, and it was to describe this sort of odd overlap of urban high-rises with suburban street patterns, very car-oriented, super blocks, windy streets, and spaciousness. At the ground, it almost looks like a suburb, but suddenly you've got really tall high-rises. That was in Israel in particular, but there are versions of that around the globe. A couple of other words, I think, that came out a little earlier in 1987, Robert Fishman, a wonderful urban historian, came up with the term technoburbs. And that was also to describe this move of that much more office, really moving out into places that were clearly suburban, but you're getting a lot more buildings that look like what we think of as urban office buildings, and yet surrounded by then loads and loads of really flat parking lots and strip malls and things. Joel Garreau then called those edge cities. And in 1997, there seems to be this tenure in the sevens. So 87 for technoburbs, 1997, we got ethnoburbs. Dr. Wei Li talking about, you know, we used to think of Chinatowns as being in the cities. By the 90s, it was very clear that the suburbs were becoming where immigrants were really landing as the cities were becoming more popular. Then there's the urb-urb comes in. Then there's metroburbs, and metroburbia are terms that have also been included into this. And a lot of it, again, I think is really because people are trying to understand, what are these places? Who lives here? You know, should we define the suburbs by their location or by their activities or by their socioeconomic kind of cultural definitions? There's lots of ways to talk about it. One of the other words that's been more recent that John Burns Real Estate Consulting in the U.S. has come up with, surban, which the Urban Land Institute has been using quite a lot. So, you know, there's a whole lot of them.
Well, Ellen, an amazing run through the urb vernacular. And I guess, you know, what we're grappling here with is an interesting thing from movies or from stereotypes in our minds. We think of these low-rise neighborhoods, nice houses for people who are commuting into the city. We know all of this is changing rapidly. And many of these communities were also set up at a time when brutally, many women were left at home as homemakers and husbands were leaving. So then there was a whole thing of like how neighborhoods worked and how kids had play areas. Everything was built into this old way of living. And as it's evolved and changed, the very nature of these places has rapidly changed as well. But when you do your book about suburbia, what's your definition of suburbia? Is it literally just the bits that wrap around the city core?
We have chosen to sort of stay a little bit out of the fray. There's a lot of urban planners who are really trying to define all these different suburbs. And the census in the US just basically defines cities and rural areas. And so the suburbs are just anything in between. There's some folks who have come up with six categories, some with three categories. June Williamson and I, my co-author, we simply look at urban form versus suburban form. And it can be at the scale of the parcel or the scale of the street network. So urban form is a box that meets a sidewalk, and if it has parking, it's under or it's behind. It's pretty much that simple. That's urban form. Suburban form is a box that's surrounded by some variety of flat-ish space that is either lawn or parking lot, and that's suburban form. And you can do the same thing. You know, urban form for street network will be in some kind of a grid, walkable size blocks, interconnected. And suburban is going to be the curly cul-de-sacs and a more tree-like sort of highway leads to arterial roads, leads to the twigs are the cul-de-sacs.
And tell me, your work is looking at how we retrofit these spaces. Perhaps explain to our listeners why they need retrofitting in the first place.
So the suburbs are aging and not very well. We built so much post-World War II was the real mass suburbanization era. And I think for decades, they've provided lots of families with access to a middle-class lifestyle, their beloved leafy places. But there's always been this attitude that we expect our cities to be dynamic and new buildings will pop up. You know, that's a good sign of a healthy economy. There's been an expectation that the suburbs should be frozen in amber at whatever form they were first built in, but they're starting to fall apart. A lot of the buildings, especially the commercial and the retail buildings. And in addition to just sort of aging out between online shopping, between a variety of retail owners just sort of buying each other up, consolidating, there's just an enormous amount of dead, vacant space that has kind of killed much of the vitality of many suburbs. The sites, the dead malls, the dying office parks, the just big parking lot dominated sites are now the chance to address the issues that the 20th century suburbs were never designed for. Issues like climate change, improving public health, social equity, competing for jobs, and most of all, kind of job one is still just reducing our dependence on the automobile because that tends to cascade and impact all the rest.
And tell me, you see these as not as places to be bulldozed or to only worry about, but as potential fixes for suburbia. So perhaps you could explain some of the projects you've seen actually taking place. I know that in some places people are looking at how you tear out the parking lot, but you grow food there, how you use old shopping malls to house seniors. What are some of the kinds of projects that are coming to the fore?
There's really three different strategies, and I think some of the best ones combine all three. So in a really strong market, it often does make sense to bulldoze what was there and just urbanize, build the downtown that that suburb never had, that is now walkable, mixed use, has a mix of all different price points and great places to gather safely. But then there's other places where, frankly, population is stagnant and it may make it better to invest more in existing downtowns. I mean, part of what's happening in the US is as a lot of shopping malls are dying, the historic little small downtowns or main streets or high streets are actually coming back for the first time in 40 or 50 years. And in many cases, that's a great thing. So you really don't want to compete with an existing town center that's struggling. in a lot of cases, it makes more sense to re-inhabit that existing box with just more community-serving uses. That might be schools, might be medical, might be workplaces. And then we love to see re-greening. That's the third strategy. We've just paved much too much of the planet, especially in the face of climate change now. It really makes sense. So one project that combines all three is called Highland in Austin, Texas. It used to be a shopping mall, the Highland Mall, and then Austin Community College. First, they just bought one of the department stores. They ended up buying the whole mall, and they have now re-inhabited the mall with a community college. But they've partnered with a developer who is now building housing and offices on the parking lots around the mall. And one of the cool things I really like in that one is that, at least in some of the cases, part of the leasing agreement is he requires the office users to hire a certain number of students as interns from the community college. And that's really nice. But then it's also got a couple of parks and a kind of ring of green around it with a trail. So it's also getting some of that regreening, and it happens to be on a brand new transit line. So you're seeing, I think, a really pretty tremendous change, and you're helping to prepare the next generation with training and jobs. You're building a much more compact, walkable place, and you're having still a connection to nature.
Ellen Dunham-Jones there, thank you so much for joining me. Up next on The Urbanist, we're off to the Netherlands. Stay tuned. Next, we look at the Dutch idea that could improve cities far beyond the Netherlands.
Woonerf. Noun. A road in which devices for reducing or slowing the flow of traffic have been installed.
It sounds like a concept every city at least tries to have a go at. But what's so unique about this particular example? Well, to explain more about the concept, we invited Chris and Melissa Bruntlett to join us. The pair's most recent book, Curbing Traffic, which is out this June via Island Press, has a section discussing this very term. They also actually live on a Woonerf themselves, so who could be better to tell us more? Earlier, this show's producer, Carlotta Rabella, was joined by Chris and Melissa, and they began by explaining exactly what a Woonerf is.
I think, yeah, the best way to describe it in the way it's often described here is basically a living street or the extension of people's living rooms.
So the design of the street is such to encourage social interaction, children playing, neighbors to congregate, maybe even enjoy a communal meal, a reclamation of the street as a public space rather than a place for cars to pass through.
And one of the reasons that the Woonerf sort of came into being was it sort of happened in this time of great experimentation here in the Netherlands with traffic calming and implementing cycling infrastructure. And the idea here was to take traffic calming to its extreme. So very, very low speeds, 15 kilometers per hour, and basically changing the street environment from one where you have this clear delineation between where the cars go and where people go to a much more flat, open space. So most of the Woonerfs that you see here in the Netherlands have playgrounds for children, benches for people to gather. And yeah, it was really the start of this idea of basically creating that communal social space in the front of people's homes as opposed to in the back of people's homes.
Now, you two are quite a perfect guest for this topic because you live in one of these streets. Tell me a bit more about what it's life like having, as you were just describing, this, you know, healthier, more recreational and calm street in front of you.
Yeah, as a couple of expat Canadians that moved to the Netherlands 2 years ago, I think we were quite taken aback by the sense of community that these streets foster, because the front of the house is seen as a space for people to connect with each other, accidentally sometimes run into each other, bump into each other, have little stop and chats, conversation, but also, as we said, long-term relationships. It creates this sense of community and social cohesion that I think a lot of places are lacking. We are, in the modern world, so isolated from one another, and our streets are seen as places for cars to drive through rather than for the people that live on those streets. And we've really gotten to know our neighbors as newcomers to this country and really found a place in this community that I don't think we would have had our streets been designed a little bit differently.
You touched there upon something which is quite interesting and one of the main issues that a lot of people face when they move to cities, the fact that there's a lack of community feeling. I mean, at least here in London, the amount of people that you would speak to that don't really know their neighbours, even though they've been living in the same area for years, that does happen. Cities do also have, as much as they are social beings on its own, they also have that side of isolation. So I'm curious here to explore a bit more about how an initiative like this, an urban planning decision like this one, like creating a VUNERV, can actually change residents' lives for the better.
Yeah, I mean, I think the benefits are probably immeasurable, but I think so often we forget, you know, how lovely it is to know the people around you and how much that creates a support system. And so I think we can actually liken it to research that we found from Bruce Appleyard and his father, Donald Appleyard, that was done in San Francisco, and this idea of heavy, medium, and light traffic neighborhoods. And if we think back to even our own childhoods or, you know, going into the 60s and the 70s, this idea of these really residential streets being these communities that would be your sort of your light traffic neighborhood where people would have their front yards, these spaces to come and gather. You know, I remember seeing images through film of even in Britain, you know, these great street parties where people come and share food. And that is sort of lost in the decades that follow as, you know, car traffic increases, the density of our cities becomes much greater. And, you know, we see much more high-rise buildings and this more isolationist approach to design. And with a VUNERV, the opportunities are not necessarily to redesign the entire, like knock down the buildings and redesign the space, but just rethink the street space in front to create a much more welcoming space where people feel more inspired to come out. And so it's not just a matter of traffic calming, but it's, you know, street furniture, thinking about creating these places for people to stop and stay and commune with their community. And I think there's examples of this popping up, not just here in the Netherlands even now, but also, you know, I think of the Mini Holland in the UK or various neighborhoods in North America where we see these traffic calming streets as places programs being put into place where it can really start to build that community back up again.
And I think Dr. Appleyard's research, the importance of the research cannot be overstated. He found a direct correlation between the volume of traffic on the street and the number of friends and acquaintances that people had on that street. So the more cars and the faster the cars were moving along that corridor, more isolated people were, they didn't know their neighbors, they spent less time on their street, they had less sense of pride in their street. They even actually spent more time at the rear of their house versus the front of their house. So when we make these decisions around transportation planning and traffic efficiency and making sure cars can go from everywhere to anywhere in our cities, we often neglect the impact that it has on the people living in those streets. And it's making a loneliness epidemic even worse because people tend to stick in their houses, stay to the back of their houses and not interact with their neighbors.
It's amazing to think how a concept that emerged as a traffic solution has so many positive consequences for residents' lives beyond, of course, how you get from A to B and just relating to traffic. It's really amazing to hear you talk about that. I'm curious then, as you mentioned earlier, you are residents of one of these streets. What are some of the things that have happened in your lives that wouldn't have happened if you perhaps lived in a different sort of street?
Yeah, there's a few funny little stories over the course of our 2 years having lived in the Netherlands now, where things that we didn't even think were possible. I guess we just have our own space and we live our own lives and we have neighbors, but you know, that's about it. And one of them that pops into our heads quite often is we actually were traveling to the UK to visit family and had left for a week and came back and our neighbor came over from across the way and just said, oh, just so you know, I noticed your number on your door was getting a little faded, so I painted it for you. And it's just such a small little gesture, but that was one thing where we're like, we didn't ask for that. We never thought that would be something that someone would do, but just, you know, out of the kindness of his heart and having that pride in a space and knowing that we were still rather new to the street and to the community, you know, it's a nice little gesture that made us feel very welcome. And since then, we've developed much stronger relationships with our neighbors. We visit for coffee every once in a while.
As Melissa was just talking, two of our neighbors walked by and just waved through our front window. So it's amazing. And another instance of this pride of space that came on after that neighbor painted our door, our street was being, some of the sewage pipes were being replaced. And the construction workers were just putting some of the curb stones back into place and the paving stones. And we noticed three of our neighbors across the street interacting with the construction workers, and they were actually helping them pick the correct paving stone, being quite picky the way the stones came together, and really helping them to do their job, because this street was an immense source of pride for them. It was their home. Some of them had even grown up on the street, were born on this street. It was as if it was their property. And I think this idea of shared communal space has been lost. And again, handing all of our public realm over to the private car, we no longer have that sense of pride and community in our neighborhoods.
Chris and Melissa Bruntlett speaking to this show's producer, Carlotta Rebello. Now to Australia to unpack a specific type of worker that's especially common in the country's more remote areas.
FIFO worker. Noun. An acronym for fly in, fly out. This is an employee in a remote area who is flown in temporarily to the worksite instead of being relocated permanently.
So apart from racking up the air miles, what effect do these specific type of workers have on the cities that they're being flown in from? And how did this way of working come about in the first place? Dr. Julian Belletta is a researcher and teacher at the University of Western Australia's School of Design, tackling issues facing Australian cities in the 21st century. Earlier, Dr. Belletta joined Monocle's Nick Manise, and he began by clarifying exactly what FIFO actually stands for.
Talking today about FIFO, which means fly in, fly out. You can also have Dido, who I believe is a singer. That's drive in, drive out. But generally, it's FIFO, which is fly in, fly out. In Australia's case, typically mining workers, typically flying out of major centres, be they the capital cities or larger regional centres, to often quite remote mine sites.
So, I mean, why has this occurred? I mean, what's the background that made flying in and out of a tiny rural town more feasible than, say, just staying in that town?
Originally, with mining developments and mining towns in, say, the Pilbara in the northwest of Western Australia, early on what happened was the mining companies actually built the towns. So in that sense, the mining companies provided accommodation, schools and everything for the people who are living in the mining towns, which is a pretty expensive kind of exercise. With economic kind of deregulation and neoliberalism on the rise in the 80s and 90s, what tended to happen was the towns sort of became normalised and the responsibility for them fell back more onto state, local state and federal governments, I suppose. And at that moment, when the mining companies start to sort of withdraw from the curation and management of the towns, then you start to get FIFO tendencies starting to occur with people flying in and flying out. So that was the kind of shift, I guess, that precipitated the move from a non-FIFO to a FIFO model such as we have now.
So I guess the shift towards FIFO sort of mirrored the shift towards governments rather than, say, companies taking responsibility for these towns. Is that correct?
Exactly. And the idea of the companies taking responsibility goes back to the idea of company towns, which have been around since the early Industrial Revolution. And there's heaps of fascinating examples of wealthy industrialists, for instance, who wanted to build company towns, which were really ennobling and healthy for their workers and their citizens. And certainly the towns in the northwest, in like the Pilbara in Western Australia, were quite modern in the sense they applied Radburn planning principles, which was regarded as being very cutting edge in the 1970s and 80s. And it was seen to kind of compensate for the harshness of the landscape and the isolation of the setting of those towns.
I mean, it seems like it was almost too much work for the government to support these clusters of populations in the middle of nowhere. And that's probably what also contributed to FIFO culture. Is there any hope of this narrative, Julian, reversing and us seeing these mining towns boom again, I guess, population-wise?
I mean, basing any sort of urban centre on mining is an always risky enterprise. And certainly, there's been a lot of planning for how you diversify the economies of mining areas, but it's notoriously difficult to do. So I think generally we're seeing growing levels of primacy in Australia for decades now. And primacy is the people living in the capital city. It continues to be where most economic opportunities are provided. And although our capital cities are getting big, they're still pretty livable. So they don't really get the push factor from them that you get from really large mega cities. So they are at once both really rich in terms of economic and social and cultural sort of opportunity, but they're still pretty livable. So I think it's very difficult for a mining town you know, hacked out of the wilderness somewhere to really compete. And I think people are also demanding more of where they live and expecting a certain level of natural and cultural amenity, which certainly some mining towns do provide, but perhaps not all of them. So these have been difficult forces for an aspiring mining town to kind of stand up against, I suppose.
Given this has led to fewer people in rural outposts, I guess, has this had an impact on the urban design or the urban fabric of larger Australian cities, those primate cities that you talk about?
Yeah, it is, because there's typically been a model in most Australian cities, with some exception, that you have the knowledge economy jobs in the core. You have the creative class and the people can access those sort of knowledge economy jobs in the inner and maybe middle ring suburbs, and that the outer ring suburbs are kind of blue collar workers, and typically, you know, they're battlers and often labouring under reasonably high mortgages and enduring punishing commutes and all the kind of, you know, stereotypes that go with outer suburban living. But I think what's happened with the FIFO thing is it's injected a lot of money into some communities that otherwise might have been sort of slightly marginalised outer suburban communities. And so we can see that in Perth, in some of the suburbs around Mandurah, which is to the south of Perth, which otherwise might not have had a lot of sort of cash flowing through them, had a lot of cash flowing through them for quite a number of years. So it probably upset that neat model of a city being defined by distance to centre and kind of socioeconomic sort of advantage and disadvantage along that spectrum as you move towards the outer suburbs. I think it's disrupted that. At the other end, in the actual towns, it's created a situation where you have a kind of itinerant group who might draw on some of the resources of the town but are not as seen as contributing to the town in any meaningful way. And therefore, there can be some antagonism between true residents and these kind of itinerant workers who have a partial allegiance to the town but not much more.
Julian Belletta there in conversation with Monocle's Nick Manise. That was just a fraction of the jargon that gets thrown around in the world of urbanism these days. So before we go, we'd like to quickly run down a few more terms that we think do with a bit of demystifying.
Herbicide. Noun. A term which literally translates as violence against the city, the destruction of whole cities or parts of the built environment for political and military ends. Arcology. Noun. A portmanteau of the words architecture and ecology, used to describe projects that reduce human impacts on the environment. NUMTOT. Noun. An acronym for New Urbanist Memes for Transit-Oriented Teens, commonly used to refer to any young person that appreciates public transit as well as urban development while fighting gentrification. Facadism. Noun. The practice of hiding a modern, often badly designed building behind the facade of a heritage building. NIMBY. Noun. An acronym for not in my backyard, meaning a person who objects to something perceived as unpleasant or hazardous in the area where they live, especially while raising no such objections to similar developments elsewhere. Strollology. Noun. The science of strolling with the aim of becoming aware of the conditions of the built environment.
That's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Today's episode was produced by Carlo Tarabello and David Stevens. David also edited the show. And to play you out of this week's episode, here's The Strokes with Hard to Explain. Thank you for listening, city lovers.